London. This is Julia Nyhan talking to Mary D. Harris for the Hidden Histories project. So many thanks for agreeing to do the interview. Is there anything that you want to ask me about the ethics forum or anything that you want to change on it?
No. I printed it out and meant to scan it back to you. I'll do that as soon as we get off the phone.
Yeah, that's great. Anytime over the next couple of days is fine.
Okay.
Just to give you an indication, so we'll do the interview now, and then I have somebody to transcribe it. So after it's transcribed, it'll come to me, and I'll do a first editing of it, and then I'll send it on to you, and at that point, you can specify any changes that you want to be made or anything that you want to leave out or whatever.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, great. And then fingers crossed it'll go into I think I mentioned to you that I've got a contact with Springer. Hopefully it'll go into that book. It'll be cited or included in the book.
Wonderful.
So is there anything that you want to ask me before we begin?
Not really. I'm curious about what the questions are, but that'll come as they come.
Yeah, great. So the first one, usually what I do is I've got kind of six core questions, and then, like, depending how it's going, I sometimes expand from them. And so the first question that I always ask is about your earliest memory in any context whatsoever of encountering computing or computing technology.
Well, I go way back. I was in college in the early 60s, and I was majoring in math. And my mother at one point said, "I guess you're going to be a math teacher," meaning in high school. And I said, "No, I don't think so." And she said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I didn't have a good idea, so I went to my advisor at the college, and she gave me some books about careers for mathematics. And one of the things that was in one of the books was about computer programming, which I didn't really know what it was. I'd heard of computers, but didn't know anything about them. And still then, I didn't know anything about them. Like I said, I was majoring in math, and the university where I was had no computer courses at all until my senior year. And a friend of mine who was in the graduate school of engineering told me that there was a one-hour course in Fortran. And because I was a senior, I could take the graduate course. So I signed up for that. It was the Fortran 2. And I didn't learn anything about the computer. All I knew was that you put cards in one side of this machine, and you pushed a button, and some more cards came out on the other side of the machine, and you ran them through another device to get the printout to see what had happened. And then you fixed the errors and went through that whole process again. So, but it was fascinating to me. I thought programming was kind of like playing a game or solving a puzzle. So I was excited about it. But then at the end of my senior year, I decided to go on to graduate school and get my master's in English literature, which I did. And after, with those tremendous credentials, I got a job working for IBM in the Los Angeles area. I went to work for the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, but was trained for 6 weeks, because all the people they hired who were smart and had, you know, logical ability and passed the programming aptitude test, none of them had any background in computer science because it wasn't taught anywhere. So there were about 20 of us in the class, and then we were assigned to different places. And I worked as an assembly language programmer out at the Jet Propulsion Lab on one of the early unmanned space shots to the moon.
Wow.
So my background is a little different from most people in digital humanities.
Yeah, absolutely. I found a note from you on Humanist, where you were talking about the University of Texas at Austin,
Yes.
and you mentioned in that you'd taken a course called Computers in the Humanities by Nell Dale,
Yes.
and you went there was a, I mean it's really a fascinating note, and you said that you found that the English department had no account with the computation center, and so there was no way for you to use the computer. And so, am I right in thinking, how do you think it came about that this class, Computers in the
Well,
Humanities, was taught in the computer science department, but there was no buy-in from the English?
after I'd worked for IBM, my husband and I moved to Austin so he could go to graduate school. And I continued to work for IBM for 1 year. And then I went back to graduate school in English. I had some uncomfortable experiences at IBM, and I sort of swore to myself, I'm never going to have anything to do with computers again. So then I went straight into an English literature program and concentrated on a bibliographical methodology, among other things. And my advisor took me over to the Humanities Research Center here at the University of Texas. And we found about 200 pages of one of Dylan Thomas's manuscripts. And the first thing that came to my mind after several years of saying I wasn't going to have anything to do with computers was, if I put this on the computer, I can get it all sorted out. So that turned into my dissertation, which was Computer Collation of Manuscript Poetry, Dylan Thomas's poem on his birthday. And I got a lot of flack from the department because I had one of the graduate advisors swore that I was trying to destroy literature by using the computer. And I found out about this class because I was trying to find out more as I was working on my dissertation. I was trying to find out more about how to use the computer for this. And the Nell Dale, who has been a lifelong friend since that course, she was in the computer science department and working on her dissertation as a computer science graduate student, and got into, I don't remember the details of it, but it had something to do with taking a text and trying to find the words that showed emotions of different sorts. And so she started teaching this class, and the class used Snowball, the Snowball language, to do some programming, and we learned about various things that were going on. So Nell kind of put me in touch with that, and it kind of gave me some confidence in what I was doing, that I wasn't the only person in the whole wide world that, that was trying to use a computer in literature. So as I went along, my goal, really from with my PhD, which was English literature and computer science, but it was sort of a secondary field in computer science. I wanted to change the world of literary analysis and literary research by showing people how to use the computer. Well, I got a lot of flack for that when I started publicizing that. And when I applied for jobs, I got mostly no's, and a couple of people that said, "That's kind of interesting, but we don't have a place for you." Now, you have to
And
remember, this is early 70s.
early 70s. And when you say applying for jobs, do you mean academic jobs?
Academic jobs, yes.
Right, okay.
Like as a professor of English literature somewhere.
Yeah.
So that didn't work out. But in the meantime, while I was trying to finish my dissertation, I went to work for a small computer company. The company was in Massachusetts, and I was living in New Orleans at the time. And just to pay the bills while I was finishing up. And then when I finally got my degree in 1975, I got a job teaching computer science at a university in Oklahoma. So I was in Oklahoma for 4 years, and then I moved back to New Orleans, and most of my academic career was at Loyola University in New Orleans. And that was when I did most of my publishing and kind of made a name for myself. But it was while I was in Oklahoma that I discovered Joe Rabin and the Computers and the Humanities group. Well, it was the publication first.
I'm sorry, were you in the computer science department there too?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was called the Department of Mathematical Sciences, but it was math, computer science, and statistics. So
is it fair for me to say that so the opposite, let's call it opposition for want of a better word, that you got when you started applying for jobs after finishing your PhD, that was from humanities departments rather than computer science departments?
Well, I really got it from both sides.
Both.
And that continued throughout my career for various reasons, because, you know, if I applied for a job as a computer scientist, my PhD is in English literature.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people along the way that sort of assumed that because it was in English literature, I must not know much about computer science. But then, you know, if they looked deeper, they saw that I was trained at IBM and had worked, you know, at that and had taught practically every course in the computer science curriculum. So I had a pretty strong background.
I was just going to say, could I just ask you a small bit more about IBM just before we go on to talk about Joe Rabin and the ACH? Tell me, you mentioned that you had I think you said a bad experience or bad experiences. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, one thing, when I was still here in Austin before I moved to New Orleans, while I was finishing up my coursework for my PhD, I had to get approval for my two foreign languages, and I had a minor in German as an undergraduate. My undergraduate degree was a Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics, and that required me to take 3 years of a foreign language, and I chose German for that, and 3.5 years of coursework was a minor. And so I made German my minor, and that gave me essentially 18 hours of electives, which mostly I took in English and philosophy. So when I got ready to move into English, I actually had a pretty strong background in both math and in English. I'm losing track of where I was. Remind me of your last question.
I was asking about the training in IBM, and if you could say a bit more about that. And you mentioned the bad experiences there.
When I was here in Austin in the English department trying to finish up and get the last little bit taken care of, I had the German covered. I took the exam for that, and that was no problem. And then the second, my second language was French, which I had to learn on my own. But once I had passed the first foreign language, I could be admitted to candidacy, which was sort of one of the hurdles to cross in moving toward the degree. And I had to get the graduate advisor to sign a form that said, yes, if you look at this document, you can see that she passed the German exam. That's all I needed, was for him to certify that I had passed the German exam. But he started asking me questions and what I was working in, and I told him about the work I was doing with the manuscripts and putting it on the computer. And I remember very clearly he sat there behind his desk and just glared at me, and he said, "Young lady, you're trying to destroy literature." It's just, you know, very dramatic terms. And I was sort of flabbergasted because I had no intention of doing that, and thought that I was doing a great service for the field. Some of the other things were more subtle. My direct advisors were very enthusiastic about the idea, and were quite helpful in terms of working things out. And once you asked earlier about what I had said about having trouble getting access to the computer, I ended up having to apply for a graduate student grant in order to get an account set up with the computer center, because in those days the English department had no account. It had never occurred to any of them to think about using the computers on campus.
Right.
I'm not even sure they did it for keeping student rolls and stuff like that, although they must have. So anyway, like I said, I got a small grant that gave me enough money for the computer time, which was fairly minimal, and the computer paper that all had to be charged to something. So that was how I handled that.
And I noted you ended up paying for something out of your own money, out of your own pocket as well. You mentioned.
I don't remember really. Did I say that on Humanist?
Yeah. So one second, I'll just find the reference. You said later when I left Austin and continued my work long distance from New Orleans, I had to hold two boxes of punch cards back to Austin, beg and borrow computer time from friends and acquaintances. And then the final processing was accomplished by using some of the funding set aside for the computer processing of D.H. Lawrence. And I later paid back the HRC out of my own pocket.
Oh, right. Right. I'd forgotten now. I had forgotten about that. I think it was one of my advisors who had a student that was working on the D.H. Lawrence manuscripts and had set up a fund, because we're talking a couple of years later after the initial grant that I had.
Right.
And there was, we had an interesting conversation about the fact that D.H. Lawrence gladly loans Dylan Thomas some computer funds or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very scholarly,
yeah.
but informal. I mean, it wasn't like anything written down. I just remember the phrase. And then I don't think I was required to pay back the money that I'd spent. It wasn't very much. It probably wasn't more than, $20 or something like that. But I did, as a just a gesture of thanks for the, because it eliminated that one hurdle, that one more hurdle.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I just wanted to briefly ask you about, before we go on to talk about the ACH, about that training that you got in IBM and what it was that you did, and maybe the perspectives that it gave you, because you at that time you would have been, I think, even in the context of humanities computing, still quite unusual in that you had formal training, so to speak, and formal experience actually of computing.
Right, It was unusual for that I ended up in the literature field and the humanities field at all. Even though I was teaching computer science, my research focused on the humanities initially, and eventually I sort of shifted into natural language processing, and never really got back to the humanities directly for various reasons. The training I got, because of the jobs that were available in those days, we were still working on what we called second generation computers. The third generation at IBM was when they came out with the 360, which was basically the basic architecture that's still the foundation for most mainframe IBM computers now. After all these years, it was when they switched from octal to hexadecimal. In other words, they made the developed the 4-bit byte and combined those to use as the foundation. So I was before that. I learned that a little later. So we were initially, I was initially trained on the IBM, gosh, I can't even remember the numbers. I'll think of it.
We can always insert it a bit later.
I can look it up somewhere. Surely there's somewhere. Anyway, we were trained in assembly language because in those days, if you didn't know the machine level language, they just assumed you didn't know anything. So the fact that I had a 1-hour course in Fortran was helpful, but not of any use to what I was going to be doing. So in the 6-week class, we sat down and learned from the very bottom. And I remember when I started actually programming at JPL, they had several different computer systems on different floors. So I'm sure along the way sometime you've seen the big room where everybody's sitting at a device and you know, something great happens and they all stand up and cheer. That was the main production area, and we were not allowed in there. That was the JPL scientists that worked in there. Our job was to develop diagnostic software that would essentially exercise the hardware to investigate whether or not it was functioning the way it was supposed to. I mean, this was very different from today, where the hardware tests itself. And back then, we actually thought that software was more reliable than hardware because everything was, you know, wired together, and you could get a loose wire, and that would totally throw everything, make everything haywire. So it was a very different world. I would think of myself as sitting inside the computer moving things around in order to accomplish whatever the goal of my programming was. And wow. This is in the days where you had a great big front of the computer with lights blinking, and you could actually set switches to change the value of a word in the computer memory and then restart it. You know, so that's how you could debug. I mean, we're talking way back. But it was really interesting, and it was an interesting background for teaching computer science. And I've never known for sure, or I've never figured out for sure how it influenced my use of computers with the humanities, but I'm sure it did give me a very different perspective, particularly from people who were coming from the humanities and then later learning computing.
And you also have this in your career, I think you also have this movement from industry to academia, and then you also did consultancy for a time.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. I mentioned that I first taught computer science in Oklahoma, and it was a really hard position because I taught so many different courses, and but I taught everything, so I learned a whole lot. And then when I went to Loyola, I actually have written several papers about some of the things that we did there, about changing the curriculum and to fit a small liberal arts college, but still teaching everything that a computer science student would know, and so on. And I published a little bit or gave papers on teaching natural language processing at the undergraduate level. And I, based on that, I wrote a book, The Introduction to Natural Language Processing, which was the first college textbook on that field, in the field. There were other books that had come out, but they were mostly compilations of papers from a conference, various ones. And because I had already taught the course, I thought, well, you know, I can do this. My book didn't stay in publication for very long, but I think it inspired some other people to write books in the field. And I could always say mine was first.
Yeah.
So based on that book, I was contacted from by a company in the Washington, D.C. area, SRA, which is now SRA International, I believe. And they were setting up a Department of Artificial Intelligence and wanted to talk to me about going to work for them. So I flew up there and talked to them, and you know, they explained what they were doing, and there were a couple of people they'd already hired. And so I moved from New Orleans up to Washington, D.C. That was in 1986. And I worked for that company for about 3 years. We did a variety of projects, mostly related to natural language processing. One of them was a project for the Air Force. The back end of it was an expert system that was related to flying sorties over Europe, and the front end of it was a natural language interface so that a person could ask questions about flying sorties by typing in questions in English.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would output answers in a combination of it was mostly kind of canned text, but it so there wasn't a lot of generation. It was mostly natural language understanding. But the Air Force never did anything with that project. It actually was fairly successful in terms of what we were able to understand and so on. But there wasn't a lot of work available in related to natural language processing, so the company kept trying to move me into different areas. And so I decided after 3 years that I would go to work for myself, and I worked as an independent consultant, and I called my little venture Language Technology, and ended up doing, I did that for about 10 years. I worked for almost 6 years with the Educational Testing Service, the SRA, I mean the GRE, SAT folks here in the U.S., and did a variety of projects for them, including a project to automatically score essays that were part of the SAT or other exams, and they didn't only use the computerized version. They would have a computer score it and a human. But it saved them a lot of money because they didn't have to pay two humans to do the scoring. And then if they didn't match, they would have a second person in human look at it. So it wasn't totally dependent on the computer, but that was very interesting. And I had a side role in the development of that. In the meantime, I had moved back to Austin. I moved here in 97 and was finishing up one project with ETS when the University of Texas contacted me about teaching for them, because that was another computer boom shortly before Y2K, when everybody was trying to hire, you know, programmers to fix things and so on. So I taught at UT for about 5 years, until 2002. And while I was there, I initially taught a course that I'm trying to think, that it's called Contemporary Issues in Computer Science. It's kind of like a Computers in Society course, but focused on the computer part of it, you know, computer science part of it. And then I suggested teaching a natural language processing course, since that was what I loved, and ended up teaching that 3 or 4 times, and worked with undergraduates doing research on a project with the AI laboratory. And I had a number of students who went on to do graduate work in natural language processing based on the work we had done. So that was very rewarding. And to add the final bit to it before we move off to something else, the last semester I was there, I knew I wasn't going to be teaching at UT anymore and wasn't sure what I would be doing, and found out from one of the other professors at UT in the computer science department that there was a small startup company that was looking for somebody to do natural language generation work for their system. It's an electronic medical record system that wanted to produce a narrative based on the data that the doctor had input about the patient. And that I ended up working for them for 9 years, and I retired from there in 2010.
Okay.
And that's my career.
Yeah. Wow. It's a really a fascinating trajectory. Tell me how was it that you met Joe Rabin and went on to become president of ACH?
The way I met Joe was that after I was teaching computer science in Oklahoma, I was still interested in English literature, and I had attended the Modern Language Association conference, which was usually held in New York City. And at the conference, I don't remember which year it was. It was probably 77 or 78 that I first met Joe, because he had a session at MLA that was related to computers and humanities. Now, he had already started the newsletter, and then later a periodical, Computers and the Humanities. And so I initially worked with Joe, helping him edit articles, and I had a, can't remember whether it was a book review, or I was in charge of some section of the journal. And then a year or so after I made that contact, he had a meeting of people who were interested in the field at one of the MLA sessions in New York, to form the Association for Computers and the Humanities. And he was elected to be the first president, and I was elected to the executive board. So he was president, I think it was a 2-year term, and I think he was president for 4 years. And then he decided after 4 years that we needed a different president, and I was sort of hand selected, and everybody knew me, and you know, it was a pretty small group. And so I kind of volunteered to be the next president, and everybody thought that was a good idea. And so I was elected, what would that, probably 80?
81, I think. 81 to 85, I think.
Okay, 81 to 85. That sounds good.
That's according to the ACH website. Is where I got those dates.
That's a lot of water under the bridge. But anyway, yes, it was. That was very interesting. And being the president for 4 years, then I decided it was time to switch, and that's when Nancy I took over. And one of the things about Nancy, I first met her when she was still a graduate student trying to find a job teaching English. She had the same kind of degree program I did, with an undergraduate degree, background in English, but she also knew computer science. And she had more academic training in computer science than I did. And I suggested to her that she try to get a job in a computer science program. And that's when she took the job at Vassar, and where she's been. I think she's about to retire now, but so it was just a conversation she and I had, saying, why don't you try this? And it really worked out well for her.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading in some of the, I was reading the early newsletters of the Association for Computing and the Humanities, and some of the editorials that you'd written when you were president. And in some of them, you were talking about how you felt that the tide was turning, that this opposition had been encountered at an earlier stage. And in the ones, I suppose, I don't know if the dates off the top of my head, I guess they would have, this would have been probably the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And you were writing that you really noticed a sort of an upsurge in interest and acceptance. And I was wondering, could you just reflect on that development as you saw it, I guess, over those years?
I'll have to think back. I think what I was referring to, or what I felt was kind of making a difference, was that there was beginning to be a little bit of publicity about some of the projects that were coming out of the field. You know, some of the early projects were very time consuming. You know, when you're dealing with punch cards and magnetic tape, and you know, that level of technology, it was really tedious, and a lot of the language work was restricted because of the limitations on computer speed and computer memory sizes. But gradually, a lot of us really hard-headed people that wanted to do, you know, computing on humanities subjects just kept at it. And so I think that as the literature and history and so on began to see that there were areas where the computer could actually help, you know, that it wasn't going to destroy literature, that it could help sort things out, help find patterns in novels or in plays and so on. And It was very gradual, but it had a lot to do with the fact that the technology was improving and the people were learning more and more from each other as we, you know, as we organized and spread the word. There was still a fair amount of reluctance of people in, say, computer science field, teaching in computer science, if their work was primarily in the humanities and vice versa. I think that continued for a long time, you know, in terms of people trying to get jobs.
Yeah.
That, in fact, that may still be the case in some places. But there was less direct opposition to it gradually over the years. I know one of the things that would make me have would have made me make say that was that I had switched jobs. The job I had in Oklahoma was they were not at all helpful, and when I moved to Loyola in New Orleans, they were very helpful and very encouraging. I was given a lot of financial support to do research and to travel to conferences and you know, just sort of publicize the field in general. So I think that helped from my personal perspective.
Maybe this question is, maybe it's kind of slightly naive, but I'm very often struck by how brave and how determined people were working at this earlier stage. You know, not only in terms of the difficulties of you know, acceptance and finding jobs and everything, but also the difficulties of just doing the work, you know.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, the amount of time that it took, and what I sometimes wonder about is how the conviction came about or where it came from that the computer really would allow something new within the context of, let's say, literature or wherever. Do you think it was, where do you think that belief came from? Was it transferring observations from successes in other areas, or what do you think was at the root of it?
I think there were a lot of different paths to that conclusion and the conviction that it was possible and that, you know, each individual should be the one that was doing it. And it was a struggle, and it was a struggle for most of us. I think that was why we were so happy, you know, to form the ACH and to, you know, to find people in other parts of the country who were working on the similar problems and had the same kinds of struggles. And, you know, why? I was such an exceptional person for my generation because I knew I wanted to go into science and math from an early age. And I've always said I wasn't very well socialized because I don't remember anybody ever telling me that girls don't do math and science. And I mean, nobody told me I couldn't until I got into college, and then I had some people telling me things that they weren't saying I couldn't, but for example, a physics professor who patted me on the knee and said, "So are you going to be my little girl?" And this was my freshman year in college, and I was sort of like, "No, that's not the way this is supposed to work." You know, so there was all of that. Plus, I had always intended to have a career, and most of my friends through school and family and everything, you know, they got college degrees, they got a job, they met somebody, they got married, and they worked until they had children, and then they stayed home with the children.
Yeah.
And I didn't stay home, and I always felt like if I had stayed home with my son, we both would have been crazy. And I mean, it was obvious to me that I needed to be working. And So if I was going to be working, then I needed to be doing something that I really enjoyed. And I could never see any reason not to combine the fields. And like I said, when I saw those manuscripts, I mean, 200 pages of handwritten manuscripts is a lot of material.
Yeah.
And trying to, what would you do? Write it out on index cards and try to sort it that way? I mean, that's basically the way people did things. And
Hello? Hello?
think you've lost me.
Oh, I have you back again there now.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
You were just saying that people used to do was writing it out on index cards. That's where it broke.
Yeah, that was the option. So the idea of putting it on the computer, of typing in from the written manuscripts all the words and all the lines and how they were worked together, it just seemed logical to me.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you do it? And I think because I had training in more than one field, I could make those connections, that synergy that comes from seeing how things work in more than one field of study. Over the years, I have found many, many people who were interested in more than one thing, and maybe they were attracted to me because of my background. But I used to say to my undergraduate computer science students, if you're interested in journalism as well as computer science, take some courses. There's going to be a need for people in journalism who know computers or in history. I mean, back then it was unusual to combine fields, but I think there's been more acceptance of that over the years, and I think some of the studies of creativity have really backed up that notion that when you've been trained to think in more than one way, you have more than just the combination. The whole idea of synergy that one plus one makes more than two, if you will.
So I think we've sort of covered a lot of the questions in a sort of roundabout ways, but I'm just going to look so something that people often remark to me is that when they got involved with the humanities computing community, that they found that it tended to be very, very welcoming and very open, and sometimes more so than other disciplines that they worked in. What would you agree with that? What do you think
Oh,
of that?
absolutely. When I first met the group that was, that knew Joe Rabin and that was attending the various meetings at the Modern Language Association, it felt like we were all old friends because we had been, doing these oddball projects off on our own for the most part. Here I was in Oklahoma, of all places. There wasn't another person in the whole state who was doing anything. But gradually, as I was in the field and more people discovered us, if you will, it was, I think we were all very encouraging to anybody because we felt like, we just wanted to increase our ranks so that we wouldn't be quite as alone. But I remember some of the early meetings. I can't remember everybody's name, but a good friend, Donald Ross at the University of Minnesota, and there was a fellow, Jim Joyce out in San Francisco, and people just all across the country that were mostly working independently who had sort of come together. So it was sort of like if you're shipwrecked and you find one more person who's shipwrecked, it's like, here, come join the club.
Yeah. Absolutely. And did you, so I was finding references to papers you gave at the Humanities Computing Conferences up to at least the 90s. Did you move away from it a bit after then, or?
Well, until I, as long as I was in the academic world, I had financial support to attend conferences. And then after I went out on my own, it was a little bit harder. But the biggest problem was that I got sick in 93. I came down with chronic fatigue syndrome, which is, in Europe is myalgic encephalomyelitis, and was quite ill for several years. I'm basically bedridden for a couple of years, and then housebound for a
Sorry.
couple more. And that's the reason I moved back to Texas, was that the cold weather in Washington, D.C. was very hard on my health. And gradually, I have been able to recover more of my ability to and energy here in the warmer climate. But that really slowed me down, and I never really got back into doing the research or making contact. I didn't totally lose contact with people, but since I wasn't attending conferences and kind of got out of the loop, I just wasn't able to keep up with it, so.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so we're talking nearly an hour. So would it be okay if I ask you just two more questions?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that'd be okay. So the first one is, so this really fascinating trajectory you've had, moving between all these various areas. When you think about your other humanities computing colleagues, in that regard, were you quite unusual compared to them?
Because my background, because I started in computing, is that what you
Well,
mean?
I think also because you were moving between academia and industry and back again and consultancy and academia and sometimes the thing about humanities computing, I suppose, is that it can be done in industry, it can be done in academia, it can be done in, say, heritage context. But what I often see is that people sometimes tend to seem to follow one path, and I'd love to get a greater handle on how common it is for people to move seamlessly, it seems, between these different spheres. But I don't really have a sense of that, and I was wondering if maybe you do.
I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of it happened to me. It wasn't always my choice to move from one place to another. When I was married, I've been married twice. The first time, I was in a fairly traditional marriage, and my husband expected me to go where he was, which I did. I mean, that's the way we did things then. There was not the agreement of we're in this together. Even at one point when I had a very strong opportunity and he didn't have a job at all, he didn't want to go because I had the opportunity. So we didn't. When I was married the second time, it was kind of the opposite. I kind of told him from the beginning, I have a career and I intend to keep working at it. And if you are willing to come along with me, then we can work this out. And that sort of worked for a little longer than the first one. But part of it was because I was in this oddball field, at, like after I was when I was trying to finish my dissertation, I did a number of things that just to support myself. I worked as a typist for about 6 months, and then I got a job with this little computer company in Massachusetts, and then I got a job teaching part-time at Loyola, where I ended up later going back on a tenure track position. Later, I took a job as a bartender in the French Quarter for about a year to just to pay the bills. I guess that was before I taught at Loyola. But I worked as a bartender and then went straight from there to teaching in the computer science department. Because it wasn't a straight path, you know, if you get a job straight out of your PhD, getting your PhD, you may stay in that job forever. But since we didn't have easy access to academic positions, and because of some of the challenges of that, I think some of it's not everybody. I mean, a lot of people stayed in the same fields. Because of my split field, it was a positive in many ways in terms of the work I did, but it was a negative in terms of what people thought of me and thought of my ability without looking at what I had done. I can't say I ever got used to it, but I certainly got to the point where I wasn't surprised by it. Even in the last job I had, you know, people would say, "Oh, I know you know about language," but they just assumed I didn't know anything about computers. And it's sort of like, how do you think I got here if I didn't know anything about computers? I don't know if I answered your question, but
thank you. That was actually very helpful. And then the other question that I wanted to ask you was about the people, and this can be sort of, I guess, from any sort of sphere. It doesn't necessarily have to be humanities computing. The people or the books or the ideas that particularly inspired you.
Well, obviously one of the people that inspired me was Nell Dale. Even though she didn't continue in the field, she kind of got me started. There was another woman whose name I can't remember right off the top of my head. I'll probably remember it eventually. She's teaching here in the School of Library Science now, but she was in Mississippi for a while working at the archives, the state archives or something like that. She was the person when I had the job in computer science and was thinking about what to do with the field and was trying to learn about natural language processing. She was the person that put me in touch with that field, you know, where to look things up and who were the people that were working in that field and so on. So those were kind of pivotal points. I had a couple of professors, one that I'm the two thesis advisors here at UT, Warner Barnes and William B. Todd, who supported me emotionally, if you will, academically, intellectually, in terms of following up on this idea, because it just was so off the wall. To get back to your previous question on that, one of the things that I found when I came back to graduate school after having been worked in at IBM, being in the computer industry, was that I felt kind of like a fish out of water, because most of the other graduate students had always been in school. You know, they might have had a summer job or worked at a camp somewhere or, you know, something to support themselves, but they had never, for the most part, been in the business world for any length of time. And I remember in one of the poetry classes, we were analyzing some poem, and the images that I came up with were so off the wall compared to these other people. And I don't remember the poet entirely, but I do remember finding out later that he was an insurance agent, that he wrote poetry on the side. So he was, I was probably closer in terms of seeing the world that he, the way he did, than these people with all their academic experience in literature. So, you know, it, I think moving back and forth like that did give me a different perspective at each point.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, so there's just one more question, and I promise we can finish up then. So I must ask you, especially when you look back at when you were president of ACH, what's the action that, say, that you were most proud of or that sticks out the most in your mind?
I think the fact that we opened the field up, one of the things that I really tried to concentrate on was to broaden the definition of humanities and even expand a little beyond that. So we kind of accepted any comers in those days, whether you would officially be defined as in the humanities or not. But initially, the group was almost entirely literature. And then we started expanding into, you know, history and archaeology and various other non-technical fields for the most part. And I think that was one thing that made a difference. And I was, because of the academic support that I got from Loyola, I was able to travel and really make it a connection. Of course, the ALLC at that point, and Susan and her colleagues were doing quite well in Europe. So, but to bridge that gap was another part of I think one of the contributions that I started, and Nancy Ide certainly continued that. She's done, traveled all over the world, and still does. Working with different people, but so this has been very entertaining to me because I don't spend a lot of time thinking back on those days, and most of the people I know nowadays have a vague idea that I did something in the computer field, but they don't have any clue about the details of what I did. So talking about, my personal history and, how we kind of got that whole thing going, I think has been very, very entertaining to me. Let me put it that way. So I thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. And thanks so much for giving me so much of your time and for such a fascinating interview.
Well, it only took us a year to get it all together. So
yeah, I know.
that's fine, and as I said, I'm retired, so I have plenty of time, and